A little bit of taste of some more Jim Webb. See you next week. In your hands, and the old men playing checkers by the tree. Cause the park is melting in the dark, all the sweet green I see blowing down. Let the kick out in the rain, and I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no.
And Earthwatch was brought to you on recording. Robert will be here live, in person. Personal appearance on Earthwatch next week. And we are very, very pleased about that. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifico Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM, and as befits the start of any of my shows, I'm sitting here having the usual technical difficulties. This one, a minor one, that Robert's show ended about a minute and a half early. And so I fill a little, but as he said so many times during that program, and rightly so, well, this was freeform. This is freeform. This is about as free as your form can get. But, here we are. It's about 1:30 in the morning in New York City, and I guess time to start the show, if I can get the darned interview I brought with me working. It'll be suspenseful. Stay tuned. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. I can now say with assurance that we will have the interview I brought with me via another computer, Karen Lord, an interview conducted just about the time. In fact, I did that show talking with Robert Knight. She's wonderful. Stay tuned. good morning. So we have for you a rebroadcast of an interview that I did. This is slightly edited down. I took out about 10 minutes of it because this was one of the last shows, actually, when Hour of the Wolf was still a two-hour show on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. And I had heard from Gavin Grant that he was about to publish a book called Indigo in Redemption by a woman I had not heard of named Karen Lord. And I took one look at her information online and was like, oh my God, of course I'm doing this interview. How amazing. And as you are about to hear, she is an utterly amazing person. And her second novel is about to come out. I was going to be recording another interview with her at World Fantasy this year, which was in Toronto. But it was in Toronto, like, the day after Hurricane Sandy. And so I just did not make it. We will figure out a way to get Karen Lord live back on the program soon. But here we have this recording, and I thought it would be befitting tonight. I just want to tell you a thing about the way this woman's mind works. She comes up to these studios at 120 Wall Street, where we are going to be for like another 2 weeks, and then we are leaving. We are running with tails and other things between our legs up to a cheaper facility all the way uptown. But we currently have this incredible view of New York Harbor. And some people would say, oh, what's that there, a helipad? Is that, which buildings are we looking at? This is just north of Wall Street. Where's the African burial ground? There are a lot of different things that people looking out would think of. There's the water taxis. She takes a look, and she said, never having been in New York before, so let me see. The glacier, when it came south, must have cut in over here, and then going north, that's where it created what was called the North River, right? Not the East River. That was called the North River. And I'm going, yes, that's right. She sees glacier movement. She sees planets. She sees people. She sees folklore. She sees wonderful, wonderful things, and she writes about them in wonderful, wonderful ways. And so that's enough of an introduction, because for the rest of it, well, as Bullwinkle would say, just listen. The first question was, and we're going to repeat it, is so tell us a bit about you, yourself. Oh, and first let me start again by thanking Gavin Grant, both for making this interview happen and for publishing this book from Small Beer Press, which he and Kelly Link and Jedediah Berry are among the people that make it happen.
Yes, absolutely. Small Beer Press is really known for finding, well, he likes to call it, what, slightly weird books. And I suppose that's where this falls, because, yes, it's fantasy. Yes, it's speculative fiction. But it comes from a folktale that had no magic in it, and I put in magic. The folktale itself is just two or three chapters, and then I expanded it. The folktales was set in Africa, West Africa, and I lifted it up and put it into a world that's kind of vaguely contemporary Earth, but you're never quite sure where it is. So lots of things became sort of slightly weird for that one. But I'm not actually slightly weird. I'm very mundane. I work as a researcher in social sciences usually, but I did decide to try to take fiction writing a bit more seriously, and that's how Redemption and Indigo came about. I will break down and admit that it was NaNoWriMo. It was the National Novel Writing Month that caused me to say, right, sit down, see if you can churn out 1,000, 2,000 words a day, put something together.
That's actually a lot, isn't it? 1,000 to 2,000 words a day.
It's pretty grueling. Yeah. It feels like work. It feels like work. And I needed something to build it on. I didn't have a fully fledged idea in my head. So I thought, well, there's this folktale I remember from when I was a child, an anthology, the Collier's Junior Encyclopedias, Volume 2, Once Upon a Time. And there was this folktale from West Africa in the sort of Senegambia, Senegal area. And it was about a woman who had a very annoying husband whose habit of gluttony caused him to get into all kinds of scrapes and difficulties and embarrassments. And rather than the happy ever after, meaning, you know, all these two get together and live forever in peace and bliss, it was all about he finally left. She got rid of him and was able to have a life that was no longer plagued by, you know, this highly embarrassing man.
And she lived happily ever after.
So I thought, okay, I'll write about her happily ever after. But in a way, and I guess one of the things that we might have been discussing before, not all fairy tales or folk tales really do have a happy ever after. There's always an edge. And for me, sometimes the edge is that if you have a strength, if you have a talent, and you're called upon to use it more, sometimes those ways are not very comfortable ways. So because I looked at this folk tale and I saw his character and she had this virtue of not only of patience, but a virtue which meant that she was not about to arbitrarily tear down someone's self-esteem to make herself feel good. Mm-hmm. She knew when it was all right to just not act, when it was all right to just, you know, step aside and let things go past for a bit. She might have had the power to be cruel. She might have had the power to make someone's life miserable. And she was able to restrain herself.
An amazing power.
And I think people overlook it. They think, you know, being tough and being powerful is all about causing people harm. And to have that kind of selectivity and that kind of compassion is rare. So the kind of adventure that I gave her afterwards was the adventure that said, right, supposing some people looked at how she handled the situation and said, okay, you know, that's rare for a human. We're going to give her an inhuman power. We're going to give her a power that only the undying ones should have. And then they have to take it from someone else. Mm. They take it from an undying one who has forfeited his right to it because he's been not like her. He's been using it improperly. He's been becoming more self-centered. And then it's a battle between the two of them. How is he going to get his power back? How is she going to learn to use it? Is she going to keep it? Is it going to change her or corrupt her? And yes, it's a bit more complex than a happy ever after by then.
And it's a bit more complex also than good versus evil or
precisely
or anything like that. This is really an issue that people have to deal with.
Yes. And I do not like good versus evil when the good and the evil are separated into different persons. Because I think a lot of the good versus evil is really the internal struggle, the self. So what you will really find there is a case of they're both struggling to find their better selves, if that doesn't sound too glib.
No.
Yeah.
No, it sounds excellent. I mean, ultimately, the problem is that we have to put all this stuff into words to communicate to our listeners. Mm-hmm. And you already had the problem of having this fabulous idea in your head, and you had to commit it to a book, which is a grueling process.
Yes.
And I know people out there listening think, oh, it's just writing.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
No.
No, it's work.
It is work.
And then you have the issue of relating it to other people in a way that they can understand. And hopefully I have some of the vocabulary of myth and speculative fiction and small presses and all that. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine what it would be like to try and describe this to Doctor.
Something you mentioned that I really wanted to expand on. You were talking about having the idea in your head, writing it down, but then getting to the point where, you know, you have an audience out there to communicate with.
Yes.
I mentioned, yes, I wrote the first draft in a month, but believe you me when I say the time for rewriting and editing is far longer than that. It was about a year before I had what I would have called a draft that looked as if it was approaching final. And that came about really because I was speaking to someone who did not have the, what shall we call it? You mentioned a vocabulary of myth and folklore and speculative fiction. I was fortunate enough to be able to run my first draft past a former boss, believe it or not. I used to work in the Foreign Service, and the permanent secretary at the time, he also writes. He wrote a play. He asked me to look at it. I looked at it. I critiqued it. He liked the critique, and I felt as if I could call in the favor, in a sense. So he looked at it, and he gave it an amazing, you know, just old breakdown, you know, this bit works, this doesn't, not sure about this character. So I was able to rewrite it in a very, very focused kind of way. And also able to see where the stronger patterns were and to strengthen those. And I really do think sometimes the way a book emerges is in the rewrites and in the editing, almost for me more than in the actual planning of it. Because while I'm writing, all sorts of new ideas come in and kind of warp the progress. But when you're at that sort of polishing, editing, rewriting stage, that for me is where a lot of the magic is.
That's great. And that's very, very important for the, well, I'm always fascinated in the craft of the book. I'm not a writer. I write nonfiction,
okay.
And, you know, about computers and stuff. Now, mm-hmm. That's a whole other talent. And I'm not bad at that, but I've never been able to write fiction.
When I was at school, and people were all like, okay, what are you going to be when you grow up kind of thing? I said, well, I want to be a writer, but I want to live a little first so I have something to write about. And I'm not telling anybody who's a young writer that they've got down pens now or anything like that, but I do think that the fascinating thing is to go and live a really exciting, adventure-filled life and then say, okay, now I can sit down and, you know, write about sailing ships and put some reality into it because I've been on one, or talk about, you know, sort of, I mean, look at, is it John le Carré, mm-hmm. writing about, you know, spies and so on. You kind of contrast
after
that.
After having been in MI5 and all
exactly.
that.
Yeah. You know, there's a feeling in that, that you cannot just sit down and make up off the top of your head. And you can bet that, yes, the actual craft, the actual putting together the words and the grammar and the spelling and everything in a particular way is important. But to be able to have that content, to be able to have that taste of reality that you bring to it, that's gold.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to keep watching you because who knows, you know, you're going to end up writing something that turns into a movie about this, you know, kind of rebel radio announcer who changes the world.
There we go. There we go.
Yeah.
No, I've had enough friends who've written great stuff that have been turned into terrible films. So,
oh, I am quite petrified at the whole making film. The only film I know that, as far as I can see, was as brilliant as the book was The Princess Bride. And really, to me, that's because the person who wrote the book wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
So he was good at both because they're not transferable skills.
They're not.
I have a lot of respect for screenwriters. I'm not going to pretend, oh, you know, you just need to have the author do it. Not at all.
William Gibson has written screenplays
mm-hmm.
And had movies made
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
of screenplays of his own stories. And
yes.
They have not worked out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one never knows. There's some minor little films that nobody has ever heard of that I think are just fabulous. And speculative fiction films
mm-hmm.
at that.
Yes.
Two I will recommend quickly, Cold Souls
mm-hmm.
and another one called Sita Sings the Blues, S-I-T-A.
Uh-huh.
That is an animated version of the Ramayana.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, classic Indian myth.
Yes.
As created by this one woman
mm-hmm.
did, she's an underground cartoonist, made
okay.
this entire feature-length film
mm-hmm.
using music from the 1930s,
all
1920s,
right. uh-huh.
late 1920s,
mm-hmm.
and all that. Just wonderful, wonderful movie. And do these even get a Hugo nomination or a Nebula Award? I attend the functions where these things happen, and
uh-huh.
that community, the science fiction community, has never heard of these films.
But I was going to say, are they aware? I mean, are we actually talking now about aspects of genre blending that are niches that they're not really aware of?
Yeah.
You're talking about something that's, you know, sort of a very indie animated thing, you know, using blues and jazz music and so forth. I can really see how that would completely be missed by someone who's, you know, looking in all the usual places at all the usual suspects. You know, there are certain presses and certain, film distributors that you can count on to be producing things that you should look at because it might be something you need to nominate. But then as something like that comes quietly at the side,
Yeah.
You know, who's the one trawling all the little film festivals? And
well, although this one was actually put to the web, it's actually Creative Commons. Anybody and everybody can download it and watch it for free at sitasingstheblues.com.
Okay.
So, number one. Number two, it was reviewed. I heard about it, aside from a couple of friends of mine, on Leonard Maltin's TV show, where he gave it a rave review. I learned about it on TV. And those people watch TV as well and probably watch some of the same shows I do.
Okay.
And the other movie, he said, wagging his finger, Cold Souls. Yes, it's a very low-budget film made by this Russian-American woman from Brooklyn. But it stars Paul Giamatti, who's a recognized, known actor, who plays an actor named Paul Giamatti. We're doing that meta thing there. Who, in order to get through a production of Uncle Vanya on Broadway, goes to a facility here in New York and checks his soul. Gets his soul taken out of him and put into a storage facility so that he can perform better, but it doesn't work. So instead, he rents a soul of a Russian poet. And has that inserted in him, whereupon he gets rave reviews. He goes back to the place. This is only the first 15 minutes of the film, by the way, that I'm telling. And only to discover that another woman who is a soul mule, she transfers souls between here and Moscow illegally by taking all the souls into her body.
Yes.
Has stolen his soul.
Wow.
So he is now soulless.
What year did this come out?
Last year.
2009. Okay. And where can I find that?
It's available on DVD.
Okay.
It's called Cold Souls. I mean, come on. What a wonderful
That's fantastic.
This is a wonderful movie. And I love the humor. It's very low key. Sorry, no fight scenes. No chase scenes. No nothing. Just wonderful storytelling.
Yes.
Wonderful storytelling. Is that genre or not?
I think we're ready for that, though. We're ready to sort of step away a bit from the explosions and maybe even a bit of the CGI and so on, and really just remember that the good storytelling is what we come for.
Yeah. And a movie like that, yes, a small independent movie, is to cinema and science fiction, if I'm using the term science fiction in its, you know, broadest term, although that is science fiction.
It is.
Is to cinema what books like Redemption and Indigo are to press, to the small press. Small press, undefinable, you know, not by a best-selling. Every book comes out is a New York Times bestseller, although the New York Times gave this book an excellent review.
It did.
It was just so bad, but it was still a great review.
Oh man, I was so grateful to him. Seriously, that was a generous review. It was beautiful.
Yeah, really was.
I've got a copy of it here to take home to my father.
Oh, good, good. Yeah.
Yeah,
you can use our copy machine to make a few to give out at Greenlight Bookstore tomorrow.
I didn't even think about that. You know, I just think, oh, you know, it's always important to keep the parents proud of you.
That's my skill set. Promoting writers, helping them figure out those little things. But tell us, you've told us a little of the book and the myth cycle, I guess, that it came from. Who are you? You are Dr. Karen Lord. You're a social scientist. What does that mean?
It means that I can work with questionnaires and interviews and get information out of people. And sometimes it ends up in programs like SPSS and becomes very kind of quantified. And sometimes it's more of a qualitative thing where I would write a report saying, well, we noticed these trends and what people are discussing about this. I know your eyes are starting to glaze over already.
No. You know, what I was thinking is I'm talking too much. Let this woman talk. It's what was going through my eyes at that moment. But go on.
Good dear. Anyways.
But so, I was going to ask, what is SPSS?
Oh, goodness. I don't even know what it stands for. But it's like a heavy-duty Excel that social scientists use, because when they do questionnaires, the questionnaires have so many options. And it allows you to crunch numbers in particular ways.
So when you say a program, you mean a computer program as opposed to like a college program.
Precisely, computer program.
Okay, sorry, go on.
Yes. But my background is even more checkered than that. And I suppose I should tell you about my background. My first degree is in physics. My first degree, I went to University of Toronto, and I did a major in physics, a minor in astronomy, but I did a specialist in history of science and technology.
Oh my God.
That's yes.
Wonderful.
It's maybe I am weird. Yeah. Shoot. Now that I think about
weird it. Weird is good.
Yeah, I guess so. So yeah, I should stop pretending to be normal then. But
I would say so. I would say so. You're special in so many ways. Why should you not acknowledge that?
There you go. So that's where I started. But what with various bits of work experience, different jobs, different bits of qualifications, I went on and did a master's. Where my life took a turn, really, was that I went to do science and technology policy as a master's in Scotland, actually, in Glasgow. So I got to have a lovely chat with Gavin about Glasgow and
oh
how much I loved
God.
It. Best year of my life. I was in the OTC. And that makes a difference because when you're in a university, lots of international students, very often you end up just hanging out with other foreigners, other people from other countries, and you don't really get a grip of the culture of the place. You might get a grip of the city culture of the place, which is sometimes not even quite fully the culture of the country because it's already accommodating a bit to all these international students. But I went into the officers training corps because I was already in the regiment at home. That's our part-time, I guess, like what you would think of as ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
And they were mostly Scots because the way their military works is that as Commonwealth, I could be part of the British Army, but it wouldn't let everybody in. See, like, okay. I don't think Americans would be allowed, for example.
Right.
But so I was basically in a situation where I was thoroughly steeped in Scottish culture and pretty much had to learn to speak Scots to be understood. I tried for a while what I like to call my generic Canadian, which is probably what you're hearing now. And they kept saying, what? So I started to speak Scots so they could understand me. So, yeah, sorry, I'm digressing. Best year of my life. Best year of my life. So after that was when I ended up going into foreign affairs quite as a shock in a way, because I thought you needed to have languages, politics, those kind of qualifications to get into the Foreign Service. But I ran into a friend of mine who was already working there, and he said, no, we're looking for people from non-traditional disciplines. I said, okay. And I went in there. And in fact, the person who I first spoke to was the very same person who I later asked to review my first draft. My life is like that, very looping back on itself. And it was actually quite cool because for quite a long time, what I did was IT and diplomacy. I was very much... Yes.
I'm going to keep saying, oh my God, as long as you keep coming up with these fabulous things.
Well, it was fantastic. I went to Malta, did a sort of 10-day workshop, and then followed by distance learning from at home. And it was all about how to use, from little trivial things like how to use chat rooms to be able to have conferences and so on, using computers and so forth.
I did a little of that professionally at a science museum here.
There you go.
Liberty Science Center. It was fabulous stuff.
Yes, great
stuff to do.
And it was utterly fascinating. And then I was encouraged to apply for a Achieving Scholarship. That's a British British High Commission advertising that, because there's a program at Oxford called the Foreign Service Program, where they do a certificate in diplomacy, but the students are all mid-career diplomats from various countries. And I applied for the scholarship and I got it, so I ended up spending a year in Oxford. And
okay, all of you at home, my head just slipped off my arm going, oh my God, again. But I'll verbalize it. Oh my God.
Well, I mentioned Oxford because the best thing about Oxford for me is, this is going to sound weird, pubs and chapels. My memory of the place is of like singing in beautiful chapels and going to the Eagle and Child. And I don't need to tell you about the Eagle and Child, do I?
Not me, but the listeners out there might want to know where C.S. Lewis and Tolkien
exactly.
and W.H. Auden came from.
Well, the whole...
The Inklings,
yes. And you really do get that feel in Oxford. Oh, sorry, I should have said the pubs, the chapels, and the libraries. And I do mention the library as being important because there's a library that it used to be called Rhodes House Library. Unfortunately, the name now is very long and complicated and something to do with Commonwealth or something. I can't remember. It changed since I left, so that's why it's not stuck in my head. But the point of the Rhodes House Library is that when I was writing the book, I said, I need to find the original because what I'm reading is a translation. And I need to find the original and see the ways in which this person has changed it because I don't want to tell his story. I want to try and get back at the original story and see what that had to say. So I need to leap ahead a bit. By the time I left Oxford, I was posted in Venezuela for a while. When I quit the Foreign Service to start my PhD, and as I was working on my PhD in Wales, I took a trip down to Oxford because I was doing research at various libraries anyway. So I took a trip down to Oxford, went into Rhodes House Library, found the original folktale that was The Core of Redemption, Indigo, because I was still tweaking it all the time. And it was Leo Frobenius, a German. He traveled and he basically collected folktales. He was not an anthropologist. He was an ethnologist, I think this is the term that they use. It was in German. Which actually I don't know. Spanish, yes. French, yes, I can read. But German was a little more of a challenge. But I will share one thing with you.
I have one word in German. That's my last name. That's
okay. So you understand me perfectly. Well, I was looking, when I was expanding the story, you get a folktale. The characters tend to be two-dimensional because it's short, because sometimes it's more about the symbol or the moral or whatever.
Yeah.
So I found myself having to try to find ways to make the three-dimensional. And of course, I was like, well, why is Ansige behaving like this? So I hope I don't spoil the story too much, but that's why I made up this story about how, you know, he was actually really the son of some chief who didn't acknowledge him. So he was like this illegitimate child in a society that put a lot of stock in being able to say who your parents are and so forth. And it made him crave recognition in ways that, you know, because that refrain, you know, don't act as if you didn't know me, you know, that very much calls out for, you know, somebody giving you attention all the time. And then I read the German and I saw enough to understand. And Sige was a bastard and had the character of a bastard. I was like, wow. I called it.
Yeah.
So I was like, whoa. So anyway, I managed to, you know, with help of people who did know German and Google Translate and whatever, pick apart the original. And
what was his source?
Collector? Was he literally went traveling through the thing, talking to people who had the oral tradition.
He got it from the oral tradition.
But that's why I do say to people when they're like, oh, you've written an African folk tale, I kind of go, whoa, I'm a Caribbean person. Mm-hmm. I found it through an English translator done by an American author who got it from a German ethnologist, and we got to trust that he actually understood what he was listening to. So it's
can
all...
Can we get more multicultural than that?
There you go. So, I mean, in terms of the three degrees of
published
of,
by a Scottish-American.
There you go. So I can't lay claim to any kind of close intimacy. There is a sort of an emotional connection because West African culture is the culture that is sort of at the bedrock of the Afro-Caribbean experience.
Mm-hmm.
But in the sense of this isn't a folk tale that my mother told me. This isn't something that was in my schools. No, it wasn't like that. It was very much stumbling across it in this book that was really an American published book, tracing it back and discovering the German origins back in what, 1870 something or so.
Wow.
I've got it in front of the book.
Is this a living folktale? Do people, is there a culture that tells this story?
I have no idea, because when he collected it back in, as I said, the late 1800s, it's one story amongst many. I mean, he also wrote volumes. If you want to write another book, go back and check his... I mean, there are more folk tales than there can be expanded on. So there's nothing that actually says more about who exactly the people were. You know, even the region. I don't even think the region has the same name anymore. There's just so much that was so vague. I tried to research it, and I realized, you know, this requires a depth and an amount of time investment that I simply can't put into it.
Right.
I'm just happy that the story is what it is, mm-hmm. and it looks like it can go somewhere. And I've already put it that it's not an African setting. It's a fantastical That's right. setting. That's why I like fantasy. Fantasy allows you to get away with things. Whenever you should always research your books well. I always believe that. And you should always treat cultures with a certain amount of respect, because I come from a culture which gets misrepresented regularly.
Yes.
And misrepresenting a culture means that someone from that culture has to bear the consequences, because I've also had to deal with consequences of people having certain impressions of Barbados and the West Indies and what we're supposed to be like and what they should expect when they come to visit it. So I do feel when you're writing, there's a sense of, you know, you want to be respectful. You want to do a certain base level of research. But ultimately, I do fall back on, I'm making this up, okay? Yeah. I'm making this up, and a lot of what you see in here is just me filling in huge blanks, you know, putting it in a completely different setting. Inspired by, Tolkien was inspired by Icelandic sagas and you know, Celtic
myths. Yes, I picked up on that a little. I picked up on a little of the not necessarily the Nibelungen Lied, but still the traditions
mm-hmm. yes.
that take from them, which, by the way, we may point out, is where Tolkien mm-hmm. drew his inspirations
exactly.
from.
Exactly. And there again, he could, because he had that academic background.
Yeah.
This was something he was already studying, so he was steeped in it.
At Oxford,
yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
So,
no Oxford, no Lord of the Rings.
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. So it really is a situation of there are books that are inspired by, that have the flavor of certain cultures, but do not pretend to be those cultures. And that's what I would like people to take Redemption as, very much owing to the influence of West Africa and the Caribbean, but not pretending to be either.
Right. Yeah, not at all. It really is a new place, which is the beauty and the joy of folk telling. And I think that, by the way, is how I would describe this. I mean, yes, it's speculative fiction. Yes, it's fantasy. But it is modern folk tale.
Thank you. I'm actually quite contented with that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a concept that has gone out of people's mm-hmm. thinking. But, you know, and a lot of the serious teachers of science fiction will say, well, science fiction is a mythology of the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's using the tropes of mythology, and we don't have mythology today.
Mm-hmm.
We have television, we have movies, we have all these things.
We have urban legends.
We certainly have urban legends, mm-hmm. and they are taken as fact,
mm-hmm.
which is what makes them what they are,
mm-hmm.
even though they're totally based on, people really do believe
mm-hmm.
these things. So, yeah, that I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, that is true, that urban legend is this kind of a thing. The problem is that people have a tendency to, well, I guess this was a problem in the past as well, that they would actually apply these things.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of what's wrong with religion
mm-hmm.
yeah, it comes from people believing the legends of their times
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and applying them in perhaps mistaken ways, even though there may be a great, wonderful ethical and moral thing underneath it.
Yes, exactly.
But the tradition of folk,
mm-hmm.
you're going to read for us, and then we're going to cap it off by asking what's coming next.
Yes, that sounds good.
I'm sorry, that was a technical glitch. We went from reel one to reel two, and I'm going to have to jump back a moment. Pardon me. People.
Listen.
I say to people, you want to do that oral tradition? Well, then.
I want to learn to do that. In fact, one of the things I started doing when I was saying, should I take this writing thing seriously, was I started looking around for a screenwriting course.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, different skill set. I didn't want to make any kind of assumptions. Oh, yeah, I can write a novel. I can just, you know, toss off. No, I don't believe that at all. Radio drama as well. I do think that's something that I would have to spend a little time learning and see what works. So I think so. Yeah.
And I think that today with, thank God that there have been stations like ours that believe in keeping that tradition alive. But what's also happening today are podcasts, people downloading things through iTunes, Audible.com, which is a part of Amazon.com. They think they can make money from it.
Beautiful.
And, you know, the very revolution that has been so dependent on the printed word, with thoughts of up to 140 characters at a throw, may also be the medium that will carry the radio tradition, the voice tradition of radio drama and storytelling, and cast it into the future.
Yes, yes. Because I know that there are big industries. We have a big publishing industry, we have a big movie industry, and perhaps that makes us think in certain boxes. And there's so many ways to tell a story. And I appreciate it. I love it when people do things where I see them combine certain methods to tell a story. And I'm like, whoa, I never thought of that. Art is another thing that can do that. But again, I'm not going to discuss that too much because that's
another thing. And that is another vocabulary and one in which on radio we're not as strong with.
Absolutely. Well, you say that, but there are some kinds of oral art.
Oh, yes.
And there is a story I've written which describes a museum. And the museum is a museum to various peoples who have died out. So there is a slab on the wall that has their names and their symbols. But there's also music playing, like the old music from the various things. There's also smells in the air, the old incense and whatever from the various rituals. And all of that is part of the museum. The museum is not just a visual experience. It's actually all the senses.
Okay, now that is fabulous. And that's the kind of writing, by the way, I expect from people like Borges.
Ah.
Who would think about that, right? Who would write of museums, write about libraries? The Library of Babel is, a singer in Borges and these other great, great storytellers.
Huh. Well, I like that compliment. Thank you.
And so you have recorded this story for where?
That story, well, Redemption in Indigo, one of the things that helped to launch it was that I entered it for a competition and it won. The Frank Collymore Literary Award in Barbados. And it's the same person indeed who was my former boss, who saw the first draft, who after I came back from the PhD said, it's on my computer. I read it again. It's really good. Even, don't worry about the rejections, send it into this competition. And I was like, I'll get feedback. Sent it in, won, was in total shock. And from that, I actually managed to get the springboard into getting it published. And I think that...
How did you submit it? Who did you submit it to before it found its way at Small Beer Press?
I was in the UK, so I submitted it to various UK publishers. Probably a lot of it was my fault in the sense I was submitting it to the usual speculative fiction genre people. I've been told since then that... it's not straight genre, so it wouldn't have really flown with them. They wouldn't know what to do with it.
That's disappointing.
But
you see, that's the problem with the straight genre, is that it is defined. And as long as it is defined...
Yeah. Once you fall outside those boxes...
It's like, it doesn't have a space... Oh, it's fantasy. Where are the elves? Or if not the elves...
Exactly.
Where are... so the moment that you create a box, the concept of fantasy is gone.
That's a very good point. Yeah, I wish more people would realize that. Yes, yes. I mean, bless Tolkien, but I don't think he intended for his work to be the defining factor
He'd be horrified.
Yes, pretty much.
He was trying to get a certain kind of Norse fable, and he was going to tell his story of anti-technology through a Norse fable and a Teutonic myth.
Uh-huh, exactly.
In a retelling in modern terms, and create a Christian myth would do all this stuff.
Yes.
The idea that, I mean, the fact that it took off is something that he was very gratified by.
Yeah.
The fact that it has become the only thing that people write is this high fantasy stuff. And then there's also sword and sorcery. Now we've defined the totality of fantasy.
Pretty much, yeah, which is scary.
As so, a genre. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But thank God that there are publishers who understand that the best of the fantastic work today, and by the way, I love those things I've just described. Not so much sword and sorcery, but I love the elvish tales and all that, and I've read Lord of the Rings umpteen times, and I broadcast my rendition of Tolkien every December of the Council of Elrond.
Oh, lovely.
Which we did as a radio reading by Baird Searle's fabulous voice, and we actually called Oxford and got Professor Tolkien on the phone to tell us about pronunciations.
Whoa.
So, you know, this is like uber cool.
Yes.
So I love that stuff. And to me, it is like one point. I won't even say cornerstone because why do you want to define a corner?
This is it. Yeah. Yeah.
The whole point of fantastic thinking, of speculative, let's deal with these words, speculative, imaginative, they are defined by the breadth of the imagination.
This is it, yes. And in some respects, I think fantasy suffers more than science fiction. I see more breadth and more ideas in science fiction than I see in fantasy. Though things are changing now, but I'm talking about, you know, especially those who are thinking straight genre fantasy, what they're thinking about, which is precisely what you've described. But to give you an example, Tolkien being one person you can hold in mind. Lewis is another person who I look at quite a lot. And he was again different because even when you look at the Narnia Chronicles, that is even a little bit aside from the whole kind of, as you say, elves, dwarves, and wizards thing.
Yeah.
But what I was saying is that the story that I mentioned to you with the museum was the second book I wrote, which I also submitted to that competition, which won just up in January.
Ooh.
And that one happened because Gavin, we were emailing, dealing with redemption, and he said, well, you know, Kelly had a look at your CV and she's surprised you don't write science fiction. And I thought,
yeah, I was thinking that when you were telling me about the physics background and astronomy and all that.
So I started writing science fiction. So I wrote, it was just stories, just like writing exercises, and it turned into a series of linked stories, which then became chapters instead, which then turned into a novel.
Right.
Which I then said, okay, if I write this much, I have to do something with it. So then I did some editing, cleaning up, submitted the competition, and actually got through. But the problem with that, again, is that I have a suspicion it's not straight science fiction.
Thank God for that. And again, I love straight science fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what's the point of science fiction if it's not going to push the boundaries?
Now, Ray Bradbury is my inspiration when it comes to science fiction.
I just finished, of course, 4 shows on Bradbury.
All right.
Well, he turned 90 2 weeks ago.
I know. It's amazing. It's fantastic. So why I always loved Bradbury's stories is that, yes, you have Mars, yes, you have rockets, but it's always about the humanity.
Absolutely.
It's always about the human condition. And I really love that. I mean,
the fact that these people are ultimately the Martians,
you know,
is almost the definition of humanity.
Yes, yes, yes. And the thing
it's
about
very poetic,
it,
Bradbury. Very poetic.
Oh, you know, which is my ultimate favorite? The Wonderful Ice Cream Suit.
Oh, okay.
I absolutely love that story.
Which was done as a radio play. But just
there
that
you
I,
go.
Just
there
that
you
I
go.
Point that out.
Yes, it can be done, definitely. So, so basically, when you have a science fiction story where there's not a big war going on, there are no huge explosions, there's no single person with a high destiny who has to slay an evil overlord.
Oh, that word, destiny, I hate that
I hate best. Yeah, you know, small destinies are quite meaningful as well. And I prefer, I mean, in a way...
No, I don't hate the word. I hate the way it is used.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
Luke, it is your destiny.
Oh, goodness, sorry. I need to take a sip of water.
Okay, absolutely. But it's an abused word. It's an abused word that lets the author cop out from writing how a story is going to go. It means that they knew everything that was going to happen to the character at the end of the story than at the beginning, and that means people don't have to live their lives. Mm-hmm. They don't have to make decisions.
And it's making decisions that make the story. It's choices is what make a story. That's the whole kind of, you know, going through the maze kind of thing. It's like, do I go left? Do I go right? What's going to change? That's what makes it all, you know, exciting to read. Sorry. You see, you're getting me fired up now.
Good. It's making great radio, I think.
Okay, okay.
You know, this to me is the essence of what this stuff is all supposed to be about. Mm-hmm.
And I want it to be more about ordinary people because... yes, there are some very amazing stories to be told of people who are in pivotal positions, you know, who are ruling countries or have amazing superpowers or what have you. But there can be such amazing things that happen to ordinary people that they have to deal with. I've been reading a lot of books recently where, as far as I'm concerned, they do a great disservice to their minor characters. And what I mean by that is that you've got, you know, your central protagonist, probably, you know, at least two very main people, and then a sort of a supporting, almost like the 12 disciples type group around them. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else is almost like a prop to facilitate whatever happens with them. And the reality of life, in a way, and what to me also makes a good story, is that you can get minor characters doing some bizarre things that completely throw off the arc. You know, that, you know, even if they're just coming in for a few minutes and going back out again, they can do some amazing things. And they have lives that are apart from yours. You know, they get on and do stuff. They're not your minions. They might just decide, you know what, I'm going to go and do something else entirely. And there's a sort of an honesty in books that I read, which do appreciate that that's what a minor character can do. So it's not about characters being three-dimensional. It's about entire worlds being three-dimensional. And a world is three-dimensional when more than one or two people
have... When it's populated.
Yeah, when it's populated. When you can look at the characters and say, you know what? All of them have souls.
Hmm.
Now you're really getting me talking nonsense.
Yeah, really. Are you familiar with Mrs. Brown in the Virginia Woolf sense?
I'm not, I'm
you
afraid.
You have a treat ahead of you.
Okay.
It is an essay by the goddess known as Ursula K. Le Guin called Science Fiction and Mrs. Brown. I haven't read it in years, but I have to. It's in her first collection of essays, which for me is just essential reading. Mm-hmm. And I have to reread it because I've started taking it for granted.
Okay.
And she has essays from Elfland to Poughkeepsie and stuff like that. But there's one called Science Fiction and Mrs. Brown. Mrs. Brown is a very, very minor character in a Virginia Woolf piece. I don't recall which. Mm-hmm. I haven't read much Woolf.
Mm-hmm.
But Le Guin talks about this. Our lead character, I don't remember whom, is in a railway car. And this woman comes in. They chat for a while. And for some reason or other, she bursts into tears.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation continues. And that woman is Mrs. Brown. And then Mrs. Brown leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And is not encountered again for the rest of the book.
Mm-hmm.
She has changed the course of the book.
And yes.
She, when she leaves, our minds go with her.
Mm-hmm.
Even
mm-hmm.
later, even though she never returns, at the end of the book we wonder about Mrs. Brown and who she is and what the dynamics of that woman are. And Le Guin's essay, which, you know, this is like 30, 35 years ago, and hopefully this has changed, and hopefully you are part of the product of what has changed, is that Le Guin says in science fiction there is no room for Mrs. Brown.
Okay. yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Because the genre is so defined, it is so, and it's not just that the genre, of course, at the time was completely male-dominated. Mm-hmm. But it is also simply the idea that it had so many set rules.
Yes, yes, yes.
That Mrs. Brown could not change the characters who have to fulfill a destiny. Now, Le Guin doesn't talk about destiny. That's me going on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I do feel that this is a common thing in there. And by the way, fantasy, especially sword and sorcery fantasy, and, mm-hmm. He didn't know he was a prince.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And by the way, I gobble those up. I mm-hmm. love those.
Mm-hmm. We all like a bit of male, wish fulfillment.
It's
we
a
do.
Male version of Ashputtel, a.k.a. Cinderella.
Yes, yes.
You know, and that's fine. You mm-hmm. know, we're allowed to dream of becoming princes. If Cinderella can dream of becoming a princess, why not? But that is, it's not fantasy per se. It's wish fulfillment within its fantasy facilitating wish fulfillment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And
but when all is said and done, what have we learned? We've had a nice little trip through wish fulfillment.
Yeah, yeah.
Cinderella does not really get a lesson at the end of her, other than, yes, dear, you're special.
True, yeah. I'm going to unfortunately go back to Tolkien again.
Please.
One of the things that struck me very strongly when I read Lord of the Rings was that, and you don't get enough of it in the film, of course, but that Frodo did all that he did and was still irreversibly scarred.
Yes. You don't get enough of it in the film.
Right.
That's right. The end of the film, mm-hmm. Sharky's End, the end of the film does not reflect the end of the novel,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
is Sharky's End.
And also him, the pain he experiences on the anniversary of these significant battles that he had and the scars he still carries. And
which is why he and Sam and Bilbo and even poor Gollum,
yes,
Smeagol,
have to go to the West because of that. And that, of course, references the whole World War I background that he brought into that, where, when you do have a destiny and when you do go on these quests, you don't come back all happy, cheerful, happy ever after. You're haunted. And
by the way, Frodo is not destined. He may be the one who can
chooses. He chooses. Each time he chooses.
Which is why, by the way, the piece that we broadcast every year is the Council of Elrond.
Mm.
It is at that council
that he chooses to take it.
That everybody chooses, that people decide whether to join mm-hmm. the fellowship. It's where the fellowship is formed, even though it cannot hold together mm-hmm. for even another book.
Yes.
There's five books in Lord of the Rings, by the way. There are. It's five books mm-hmm. and three appendices. The volumes that publishers have put it into.
Six books, actually.
Tolkien's control. Tolkien wrote one novel of five books.
And now people think they have to write trilogies because they see those three books and they think that's how fantasy goes, but it's not quite like that.
Well, it's an important marketing thing.
Yeah.
And it does go that way because, mm-hmm. because it sells.
True. But yeah, as you said, Frodo's choice is so powerful.
Frodo's choice,
And not only that, because, and this is what I will definitely praise the movie for. Movies are good because they add visually what you will never be able to get out of a book just by reading. And one of the things they added visually was the look on Gandalf's face when Frodo said, "I will take the ring." It was perfectly acted. There was that expression. It was the expression of a father watching his son go off to the trenches. It really was.
It really was. And for that, we have to say praise Ian McKellen.
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
And Peter Jackson for allowing mm-hmm. that Ian McKellen moment to come through. And I've seen him on stage, mm-hmm. and he's
powerful.
Quite the presence.
Yes.
He's quite the presence. He's powerful beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
But what I argued, mm-hmm. the year that I broadcast the Council of Elrond before the movie came out, this. I warned everybody. I said, this is your last chance. This is the last chance that Frodo will not look like that actor.
You're so right.
Because it is now imprinted in our mind. Before, I had many Frodos. I had the Frodo of this artist, of that artist, of the depictions that Tolkien did, because Tolkien drew a lot himself, although he almost never did the characters. Mm-hmm. He did the places, which actually are preserved very nicely in the film.
Yes.
But exactly what does Gandalf look like? Well, he looks like Ian McKellen, and he will never not look like Ian
it's
McKellen.
True.
No matter who may play the role in the near future, it will be Ian McKellen. Mm-hmm. And before that movie came out, I had my own Gandalf. Who was a closer Gandalf because I was direct to the words that Tolkien wrote, direct from him to my mind's eye. And the written word is, I will say, the second best version. The best version is the spoken word. Now, some people may reverse that. And I'll say, you know what? Okay, fine. You want to say written word is better than spoken word, be that way. That's your craft. And that's just fine. I work on radio.
Yeah, so that's where your strength is. That's where your talent is.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. In presenting, not in being, but presenting and interpreting the spoken word, because I will do readings. I do readings. Although I'm the one who prefers the author's voice.
Oh, dear. Is this you?
We're getting there. We're getting there. And we can take a break first.
Okay, that will be good.
But the author's voice is a very special voice. Most, the only other radio show that I'm aware of that presents fiction on a regular basis, Selected Shorts on National Public Radio, they have actors. Very gifted, brilliant, wonderful actors. I am not putting down a show that reads short stories. That will not happen. I will never do that. But how many shows ask the writers to read and then get indignant? Now, we haven't even discussed the NALO issue. Ms. Hopkinson, she's not the Audubon, but somebody just ought to confer a doctorate upon her. But anyway, Nalo Hopkinson auditioned to do the audiobook of the robber.
Midnight Robber?
Midnight Robber, thank you. I was trying to, I was Europeanizing it, and I had the robber bridegroom in my head, which is a completely different story, the Midnight Robber, the great Caribbean, Trinidad, is that?
I'm not sure.
I think it's Trinidad. I have a story I'll tell you about Nalo and that story, and WBAI, but off here. She auditioned to read that for the audiobook, and she was turned down. Her voice wasn't good enough. Now, have you ever heard Nalo read? It's magic. She's great. She's not good. Okay, so I produce this radio show where authors come on and read. I curate and produce the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, just as Gavin used to, and now Matt Kressel and Ellen Datlow put together the KGB reading series. The author's voice. Sometimes the authors are not as skilled as the professional actors. But at no point can you tell me that the authors are not better at conveying.
We know how it sounded in our heads.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. True. Yeah.
Okay. So with that note, we're going to take a break. And then we will be back shortly with Karen Lord. You're going to
And this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and we are going to take a musical break at this point. We're listening to an interview that I did with Karen Lord about I actually slated it there. It would be about 2.5 years ago at this point. And I want to comment to myself that actually some of those things are slightly changing. Thanks to people like Ellen Kushner and Neil Gaiman, where they have such skills. Ellen coming out of National Public Radio, Gaiman being, aside from being a decent reader, being a real media knowledgeable kind of a guy who can perform well, he is creating a place for authors to do their stuff. And even more importantly, a little bit more radio drama than just straight readings. I, however, will still, well, I'll champion the author's voice on the straight readings. Now, I had mentioned that, of course, Redemption in Indigo was Karen Lord's first book. And by the way, her last name is spelled L-O-R-D. And just tell you her website. Hold on. At least her blog. I'm going to have to give it to you afterward because you know what? It's very, very tiny type, and I'm not wearing my glasses, as all of you watching your radios would know. So I'll tell you in a little while. Or you just Google up Karen Lord, L-O-R-D, and that'll be the first thing there. So her first novel, the one published by Small Beer Press, was Redemption in Indigo, which is what we were discussing and what we're about to hear a portion from. But the next novel, the new one, coming out next month, is called The Best of All Possible Worlds.
Let us review lesson 11.
Paragraph 2 and scene of 7.
Once one dismisses the rest of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Once one dismisses the best of all possible worlds, one finds that this is the best of all possible worlds.
Pray classify pigeons and camels.
Pigeons can fly.
Camels are mammals.
Well, there is a reason for everything under the sun.
There is a season for everything under the sun.
Objection! What about snakes?
Snakes! 'Twas snake that tempted Mother Eve. Because of snake, we now believe that though depraved, we can be saved from hellfire and damnation.
Because of snake's temptation.
If snake had not seduced our lot and primed us for salvation, Jehovah could not pardon all the sins that we call cardinal, involving bed and bottle.
Now up to Aristotle.
A mankind is one, all men are brothers.
As have done to one to others.
It's understood in this best of all possible worlds.
Also the good in this best of all possible worlds.
Objection! What about war?
War? Though war may seem a bloody curse, it is a blessing in reverse. When cannon roar, both rich and poor by danger are united.
Till every wrong is righted.
Philosophers make evident the point that I have cited. Since war makes equal, as it were, the noble and the commoner. Thus war improves relations.
Now on to conjugations.
Amo amas, amat amamus.
Amo amas, amat amamus.
Proving that this is the best of all possible worlds.
With love and kisses, the best of all possible worlds.
Quodera demonstrandum.
Quodera demonstrandum.
Quodera demonstrandum.
Candide, the wonderful, wonderful Candide, and probably the best performance of it ever. That was a live performance done in London some years ago, not long before Bernstein died. And he was the conductor, Jerry Hadley, June Anderson, the amazing June Anderson, Adolph Green, Kirk Ullman, Delia Jones, with the London Symphonic Orchestra. This is WBAI in New York City. Non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM. The program Hour of the Wolf. My name, Jim Freund. The website for Hour of the Wolf, by the way, is ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. It looks very old-fashioned, but the information on it is semi-up-to-date, as long as you don't look for what's on the next show. And also, there's a Facebook group. If you go to Facebook and look up Hour of the Wolf, it says it's public. Yeah, I made it public. It's supposed to be that anybody can join, but then I always see requests from people to join. So just go in there, and if it tells you, do you want to join, you say yes, and as soon as I get home or to my smartphone or whatever, I will approve it. We are listening to an interview with the author of The Best of All Possible Worlds, a novel coming out next month, and Redemption in Indigo, which came out a little over 2 years ago from Small Beer Press. And the person is Karen Lord, and we will now continue. You're going to read for us, and then we're going to cap it off by asking what's coming next.
Yes, that sounds good. That sounds excellent. Well, before I read, I kind of have to give a little bit of context so that you're not completely lost as I dive into Chapter 8. I mentioned before that we have the protagonist, Palma, who is a human woman who's been given a power that is wielded only by the Undying. The Undying One, who it has been taken from, is the person who I'm going to be reading about. And his, well, let's say his pseudonym for now is the Indigo Lord. He is going to try to find out where his power is. And another of his kin, who is actually a spider trickster, and I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure that that, you know, you can't have an African folktale without having a spider trickster somewhere along the way.
You can't have a folktale without a trickster.
There you go.
And a spider trickster is one of the best.
Exactly. So he's had a conversation with the spider, and the spider has said, "Oh, well, you know, I know where this power is. You know, I don't know what your type are trying, but you know, this human has this power, and she seems to be quite a natural with it." So he's been needling him a bit, and now the Indigo Lord decides he has to go to Palma's village and find out where his power is. But he doesn't actually know it's Palma who has it. He just knows that it's somewhere there in that village, and he has to find out who, and he has to find out how to get it back. So, the Indigo Lord spies on the citizens of Makenda. To walk boldly into Makenda would not be prudent. At the very least, the exercise demanded some initial reconnaissance. The Indigo Lord reluctantly decided to take up that despised practice, stealing the shadow of an insect. However, to save time and emphasize his superior ability, he took not one, but several at once, honeybees, dragonflies, and a handful of ladybirds. Shadowing multiple insects of multiple species was a pleasurable challenge, one that so occupied his mind that there was little energy left for fretting and fuming. His dragonflies patrolled the river and the wells and the ponds where the livestock were watered. The ladybirds bore the protection of superstition, for they were considered lucky, so he allowed them to settle on people's clothing and travel with them into houses where they could overhear all the latest gossip. The honeybees flew in and out of everywhere, but were often distracted by flower gardens and kitchens. He managed them all with the fine skill of an orchestral conductor, scanning the news they found for information that would help him regain his power. It became clear to him very quickly that the people of Makenda had no inkling of what was in their midst. He began to worry that perhaps the spider had, after all, sent him to scramble uselessly on a fruitless errand. Then he consoled himself. There was no way that any Jombi could sense his presence in Makenda, with his power so widely diffused into such weak shadows. Sorry, I just have to point out the name Jombi is what the Undying Ones are called in Palma's world. Also, why assume that the person who held the chaos power was indeed as proficient as the spider claimed? Chaos was a far subtler force than most people realized. It would be so easy to sense if it threw off thunderbolts or sent barely sensed thrummings through the fabric of reality, but it was nothing more than the possible made probable. It did not break or bend any laws of nature or tip the balance of the universe. How would a mere human understand how to manipulate it? They would end up thinking they were merely lucky or blessed. Finding someone who held an unused or little used focus of chaos was akin to the unenviable task of trying to find a needle in a haystack. He tried to see if there was anyone who stood out from the crowd. He looked for the village herb woman. He scrutinized the chief. He examined the local priest. They were all within the ordinary mold, with ordinary events surrounding them. Then he spied for a while on the strongest hunters, the most successful farmers, the wealthiest merchants. None of them had come by their fortunes recently and serendipitously. Finally, growing bored at last and ready to give up, he looked at the women of Makenda to see who was the most powerful matriarch. It took a bit of stretch of the imagination, but the only person who remotely stood out was Tasi. It made sense in a way. She was not a woman who stood out for her own merits, and yet her husband was prosperous enough and respected among the village elders, her daughters were of good repute, and her kitchen drew ordinary passers-by like honey draws sugar ants. As he pieced together the gossip, he became even more certain. Her older daughter had married a man considered foolish even by human standards. When he came to Makenda to see his estranged wife, bizarre accidents were the result. He'd left the village without her and with very little of his dignity. Yes, ridicule was the weapon of the quiet woman. His insects focused their attention on Tasi's household. Not only the kitchen attracted visitors. The younger daughter, who was still single, had several strings of admirers. It seemed as if Tasi was employing a very strict screening process, however. Before the suitors were given any opportunity at conversation with the object of their desire, they had to sit through a detailed interview with Tasi and her older daughter. Few made it past this first intimidating obstacle, and those who did endured the chaperoned visits for interminable weeks after that. There were compensations. The food of Tasi's kitchen was truly delightful by all accounts. However, no one had as yet gained the prize. Still, he needed confirmation. These were only hints, and he was not about to make a fool of himself for the trickster to gloat over him. Then, at last, he found it. A junior, cunningly hidden in the shadow of a child, had insinuated itself into Tasi's household. He instantly grew cautious. Sending away all but two of his shadows, he flew a bee in at the kitchen window and walked a ladybird over the threshold of the back door. "Why don't you simply show me how to use it?" murmured a woman's voice. "I would rather not even touch it," a child whispered back. His shadows were poorly positioned for a clear sight of the speakers. The jombi was easily identified by its piping child's voice, but the voice of the other could have been either of Tasi's daughters, for all he could tell. He turned the bee and flew to the other side of the room so that he could see the faces. Splat! There was a sudden loss of aerial vision. His bee had been swatted. "Nayla, why did you do that?" "I hate bees. They look like they're waiting to sting you for no good reason." "That's wasp, Nayla. You like honey, don't you? Then let the bees live." Those two voices were almost identical. He was growing confused. Determinedly, he set his ladybird crawling up a wall for a better line of sight. When he turned it about to look down at the room, he saw the two daughters and the child's shadow. The child was looking up at his ladybird with an expression of cold suspicion, and he realized that he had spent too much time getting into position. "Would you kill that ladybird?" it said to Nayla, continuing to look meaningfully at the bright red beetle. "Don't be silly. No one would kill a ladybird. What would happen to all my luck if I did a thing like that?" A pot on the stove rattled. The older daughter was stirring the contents and examining them closely. "The syrup is ready," she announced, bringing the steaming pot to the table and setting it on a round of stone. A sheet of chilled metal was also on the table. She took out a generous dollop of syrup and handed the spoon to the child, who then carefully dribbled strings of syrup onto the cold metal. There was more confirmation if he needed it. The strings tumbled into weird spirals and highly specific knots, a sure sign of chaos if one knew what to look for. But the jambi wasn't doing it, at least not if he understood the first exchange correctly. Tassie wasn't in the room, so it wasn't her. The two sisters sat with heads close together, watching the liquid as it curled into its patterns and peeling it off when it solidified. It had to be one of them. He believed it must be the younger. A woman cautious of her luck, but contemptuous of the lives of bees, with half the men in the village and some from out of it beating down her door, yet perhaps close enough to her sister to do her the favor of ridding her of the encumbrance of a foolish husband. Yes, it was very likely. He had no idea how biased he had become. He saw Nayla's beauty, her casual cruelty, and her boredom, and he saw himself. Naturally, he believed her to be the one gifted with this stolen power. Careful not to attract attention, he let the ladybird fly away home. He no longer needed it. He felt so pleased with himself that instead of returning to conjuring the hall, he relaxed and imagined himself in a warm, sunny pasture to lie in while he plotted out the recovery of his power. There was still the problem of where the focus was located. Humans did not hold such power within themselves easily. They had a deep-seated need for symbols, talismans, and representations. Somewhere in that house was the symbol of the force of chaos, and unless he took that with him, he could not take back the power. The junior jambi would be on the alert now. It would look out for insects and guard its words from being overheard, and warn the women to guard theirs too. It would double its efforts to teach Nayla how to use her new gift effectively. He had little time if he hoped to avoid an unseemly battle with juniors and inferiors. He remembered Nayla's offhand tones after she spoke of killing the bee. She was interesting in a mundane and wholly human kind of way. Perhaps he could convince her to give up his power without a struggle. She looks like a woman who could be bribed. In fact, she looked like a woman who could be flattered. If he came to her as a suitor, with enough wealth and beauty to dazzle her, would she even notice that her power over chaos was no more when she saw all the apparent luck around her? True, it had been a while since he walked the earth in human role, but there were precedents. It might be the easiest way to get back his power. Who knows what terrible things they had said to her about him? Better that he try honey and temptation to reach his goals, rather than an attempt to use force, which might only justify any misconceptions already given. Now I'm going to jump ahead just a little bit to the actual execution of his plot to get it back from Nayla, who he thinks has the power of the stick. He goes to Makenda as a merchant prince, but he knows he can't really communicate with humans very well, so he decides to hire someone to say the words for him. And this is about this person. Alton, the poet, was a man setting out on a long journey for the first time. Because he did not look young, people assumed that he had been a long time at his job and must be something of a master. The reality was that premature greying had crowned him with an appearance of greater maturity than was actually the case. He truly was a poet, but a very young one, who was only now testing out ways to make money from his art, if art it was. A terribly shy man, he was far too self-deprecating, an unhelpful trait in any person who aims to sell snatches of empty air shaped around vowels and consonants, or worse, bits of white paper irregularly stained with black ink. When he had been hired by Beanie, he had mistaken the majordomo for the master, but when he saw who the master really was, his worries increased. Once he would have thought himself beyond fortunate to be in the household of a rich merchant prince, but fantasies and dreams worked well enough when unfulfilled. Now he would have to produce work worthy of his exalted position, and the muse in him fled in terror at the thought. On reaching Makenda, he relaxed slightly. This was the kind of village that a city man like himself rarely took seriously. It was his own fault, perhaps, that he was so lulled and vulnerable when Beanie called him into the tent office to receive his first assignment. "You are to write a love poem." Alton looked at him, expecting more, but Beanie's face was poker bland. Just a love poem? Might I ask for whom? I mean, I don't want to be nosy, but it helps if you can imagine who you're writing to and maybe why you're writing to them. Or is this just an arbitrary love poem? He stammered. There is a woman named Nyla in Makenda. Her mother is Tassie, her father is Semwe, and she is not yet married. The poem is to be addressed to her, and it will be signed by our Lord. Then you will deliver it to her, orally, as well as on paper. Alton flinched. His penmanship had always been excellent, but his oratory was more of a challenge. "By tomorrow," Beanie concluded. Deadlines were the one thing guaranteed to pour ice water all over Alton's creativity. He fished for help, something to delay the inevitable. "I have not even seen the subject. Where will I get my inspiration?" Beanie got up from his desk and patiently led the young man out of the tent. He pointed across the pastures towards the edge of the village, where young women were fetching water from the village well. "Go and see. Try not to get too inspired." Alton set off, trying to appear unconcerned. Women fell into that category of fantasies and dreams that worked well when unfulfilled, but presented all kinds of problems when brought into the world, real world of trial and failure. Only his greater fear of being fired pushed him on towards the well and took his trembling legs to the edge of the group of chattering women. A few fell silent and gave him that dismissive up-and-down flash of the eye that women could be so horribly good at. The rest ignored him. Then one of the women turned around. It was exactly like the master poets had written it. The air seemed to turn hollow, muting the sound of chatter to mere background warbles. The other women became like so much wallpaper, a neutral background for the vividness of the central figure. He heard a voice say, "You must be Nyla. I am Alton, poet of the household of the Lord Taran." This could hardly be his own voice. It rolled, it thundered boldly. It was the voice of one who knew that he would be heard. Giddy with this unlooked-for power, he continued speaking, fueled by a rare vintage of courage. This was not Taran's doing. Taran might have done something, perhaps if the first draft of a poem had come for his signature and had proved substandard, but he had not even heard Alton speak as yet. What Alton did was not at all remarkable. Like many men before him, he had simply fallen in love with the face of the most beautiful woman in the village, and in so doing, had found his muse. There you go.
That's wonderful. That's just marvelous.
Thank you.
So to, I think we're going straight from the end of that into music, and now we're back.
Well, actually, now we're gone. Because, well, we have a little under a minute to go. And as I said, this was a cut-down version of a program originally produced for 2 hours. But what you need to know is that the writer who we had here, WBAI, was Karen Lord. And Google her up to find out more. Her first novel, which you heard her reading Chapter 8 from, is Redemption in Indigo. And her brand new book, which I've not yet read, coming out next month, is entitled The Best of All Possible Worlds. And, well, you know, what can we say? Any book, any world that is publishing her stuff, well, indeed, that comes close to being a best of all possible worlds. Speaking of which, this has been Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clapper with Lister coming your way on these airwaves in just about 3 minutes. We go out, as always, with Sails of Silver from the same album of the same name by Steel Eye Span. Check us out on Facebook at Hour of the Wolf. Just Google that up. There's a site for the movie, and there's a site for the radio show. I'm the radio show. Ingmar Bergman was the movie. And follow me on Twitter, @JimFreund, JimFreund. So, oh yeah, OurWolf.com. We have a website. Remember websites? Sure you do. Thanks for listening again, and talk at you next week.
find the people who hate this shit. These are the places we'll hit.
Number one,
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangled. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom! This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I torch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn it.
Never in this world happiness is so. Never in this world.
if you want to get the knock, you really got to beat the clock. Hey! And when I really take a stock, I'm gonna play it back. Tell you, first time to rock the nation, and with the rockin' vibration, make a tell it to your girl. Hey! Come on and wheel the world and tell it to you. Calling all dancers to tune down to the station, make a rock you with dispersion. Sneeze and the fly get down his knees. Tell it to your girl, like a